Money FM 89.3, best of your money. Money and Me on Your Money, only on Money FM 89.3.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. I watched a really great interview with Ray Dalio a couple of hours back, and you know, I thought we'd take that same format and put it to our Arun Pai, Chief Strategy Officer at Flow, who we check in with every week. Arun, how are you today? Good morning.
I'm very good, Michelle. Thank you for having me as always.
So Ray Dalio was asked, where are we in the economy? And he pointed to debt, what it means for inflation. He pointed to internal conflict over wealth over in the UK, and he pointed to the rise of China. Of course, his time frame was a few years in terms of where are we in the economy. But I'll put that same question to you. I mean, what is an investor to do when we see stock indices around the globe set to register losses for the month of September, at least? Thank goodness we have 2 days left of it only. And worries over the potential failure of China's real estate giant Evergrande. Apart from that, we've heard Powell and Yellen warning of a devastating impact of a U.S. debt default. China today considering hiking industrial power prices to ease its power crunch. Where are we in the economy?
Let's begin with, like, the first point that you mentioned about Evergrande. You know, we talked about it last week. My thesis hasn't changed. It's going to be a short-term correction for sure, just given the scale and size of the potential default. But I don't think it's going to be, quote-unquote, the Lehman moment for the market. Right. So as an investor, there'll always be positive news. There's always going to be negative news. You need to try and balance the two of them out and see on a risk reward basis where to deploy your capital. So from that regard, I think I'm not that bothered. I mean, obviously, you got to keep focusing on the news and seeing what new information comes out of China and the specific company. But as of right now, at least, I don't believe it to be a big Lehman moment. The debt crisis and the debt ceiling that's going on in the U.S., this has been going on for the past like 10 years, right? You know, ever since the global financial crisis and the Fed expanding its balance sheet in by the trillions, it's always been this issue of the House and the Senate coming. So far, I mean, there've been small little scares here and there. Mm-hmm. But again, one of these other things where it makes news grabbing headlines that the U.S. government might shut down, the U.S. government might default. If anything, if there is a certain correction on the back of that, I remember like when the U.S.'s AAA ratings were reduced by some credit agencies, I think the markets corrected by 6% in that day. To me, again, that would be a potential opportunity to buy rather than, you know, get scared and try to like sell out of that market. So those are all the potentially negative news headlines that I think we will be seeing a lot more of. And I would try to use them to try and, you know, invest back some more money in the market. I think the topic or the theme of inflation is something that's a lot scarier and something that I believe at least that we will be talking about on this show at least for the next, you know, 6 months to a year to come. Mm-hmm. And why do I say that is because inflation is definitely, you know, running hot right now. And what that means is I believe the Fed will be forced to some extent to try to increase interest rates to try and temper that inflation a little bit quicker or potentially even a lot quicker than what the market is pricing it. And, you know, we all like, I think Warren Buffett said it best when it comes to interest rates, they're like gravity to asset prices, right? So we increase interest rates, gravity goes up, asset prices come down. So that's something that I believe investors should be extremely concerned about. You know, Powell came out saying this inflation is frustrating. He blamed it on supply chain bottlenecks primarily, which to some extent is true. Don't take me wrong. Like you look at container ship stocks, for example, they're up like 6x this year, right? The huge increases in charter rates for container stocks. But in terms of actual core inflation numbers, just back 3 months ago in June, the FOMC, basically the Fed, was saying that it's going to be 3%. They just came out last week saying that it's going to be 3.7%. So it's a massive jump. And we know the Fed was initially saying, you know, target of 2% inflation, but they'll let it spike over that amount because they have to compensate for the fact that it's basically been 0 or 0.5% for the past 5 years. It's starting to get to a point that gets a little bit more worrisome. And if these inflation numbers don't subside, which I don't believe it will, then the Fed might have to get into action a little bit quicker, and that could lead to a lot more volatility in the market.
I want to pick up on this point of inflation. So Powell expects inflation to run into next year. Is it logical then for the investor to be looking out for companies that could stand to benefit in an inflationary environment? So strong pricing power, those that can pass on price hikes to consumers, those who may be even able to increase their margins.
Absolutely. I think that is where the complete focus of the investor should be on. And then where should the investor not be looking at? I would say fixed income instruments as well as technology stocks. Like any underlying like industry or sector where valuations are way too high, mm-hmm. I think there'll be a big rejig where capital will start being taken out from quote unquote these storied stocks whose valuations have been very questionable, but it's just been running amok, given extremely low interest rates.
Could you give us an example?
Tesla. I mean, and it's interesting, right? Like Cathie Woods, Shamath, both came out in the past like a week odd, saying that they've cleared out their Tesla position. The stock price hasn't moved. If anything, it's close to like $800, give or take, at close to like $760 billion market cap, forward PE of like close to 500. It's something that I think investors should be a lot more scared of, right? Where you've gotten these large guys who've gotten out of this stock, and they've been the ones who've been pumping it up for the past like 2-3 years. They're cashing out. The stock price has not moved that much, which obviously means that a whole bunch of other institutional investors, but no one's exactly come out saying that they've bought Tesla by the billions. Instead, it must be retail investors. And, you know, the retail investors should not be the last ones holding the bag. So it's something to just be a bit careful of, to come too late into the party thinking that, you know, tech stocks will always go up regardless of valuations, the SaaS business models. I mean, not just Tesla in terms of the tech aspect, but, you know, like these software as a service companies, the likes of Peloton, Palantir, like all of these businesses that are running at like massive, massive premiums in terms of they are even forward PEs. It's something to be a little bit concerned about and go back to, you know, finance 101. Which companies, exactly like you mentioned, solid balance sheet, good pricing power, inflation, even if it starts not going too high, obviously, because once if it gets into a hyperinflation area, then, you know, all bets are off. But if inflation does spike up to over, say, 4-4.5%, Fed starts increasing interest rates a lot quicker, bond tapering takes place a lot quicker, then it goes back down to the basics of which company can survive the next 3 to 5 years of relatively high inflation rates by passing that on to the consumer. Like which brand names can you think of that people would not mind spending more, you know, an extra 5 or 10% year on year just because they want that product or service?
Makes a lot of sense. I want to keep on this investor viewpoint, but this time pivot to the power crunch. Are there some sectors, some companies that stand to benefit from the power crunch as you see it?
Absolutely. I mean, this oil, you know, breaching $80 for the first time in 3 years. We've seen natural gas spike up like over 30% just this month. But then yesterday there was a big correction of like 6-8%. Uranium is something that is really interesting, and I'll talk a little bit about that later. But overall, in terms of the entire oil segment, demand is definitely coming back, right? Mm-hmm. If you look at, you know, expectations of like really large energy giant Vitol, they've come out saying there's going to be a surge of requirement of oil to the tune of around 500,000 barrels per day. OPEC seems to think that's going to be a little bit lower at about 370,000 barrels per day, as in the increase in the demand in the market by the end of the year. So I think overall, in terms of tailwinds for the sector, I think they're quite strong. Delta COVID variant aside, I feel that as we come closer to the end of the year, I mean, look at the recent Champions League football matches, right? Like the crowds are full, entertainment is back. I think there's a first concert that's happening in the US tomorrow or day after, excluding Singapore, sadly, but Europe and the US are pretty much back in business. Travel is coming back in. We've seen these huge jams in the UK because of lack of gas or fuel, whatever you want to call it, at stations. So I think from all of that regard, there's definitely a lot of pent-up demand.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to see a lot of potential benefits from there for as an investor being invested in this sector. It could be anywhere from like the Exxon Mobils of the world, which mm-hmm. I think are trading at very cheap multiples, and to maybe more nuanced plays of oil transportation. You know, the tanker segment has been really badly bruised in the past couple of months. I think product tankers, STNG, that's one name that I find to be quite interesting. It has a very young fleet, really like that stock, trading at attractive multiples based on forward PE expectation. So I think the transportation of energy segment, natural gas, as well as just general, like these oil behemoths like ExxonMobil and Chevron and stuff, could be quite interesting.
So companies companies that export gas and mine coal as well?
Coal is an interesting segment. I mean, you have the headwinds of this whole ESG theme that's going around in the markets, right, where the world's largest money managers are saying, we're not going to be able to put in money into this because of our in-house fund restrictions. I mean, China's come out saying that they're not going to fund any external coal plant. But at the end of the day, for the entire world to completely pivot to quote-unquote clean energy, it's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to happen over the next 5 years. So from that aspect, I really do feel, you know, as an investor, sure, invest into ESG stocks so that you can sleep better at night. But from a pure return perspective and at what and at how attractive valuations many of these stocks are trading at, I do feel some amount of the portfolio could be allocated to that if you're purely looking at return.
So with natural gas prices soaring, we saw investors sort of flocking to red-hot uranium stocks. There was a decline in prices last week, but about 3 days ago, we saw a bit of a pop. Do you think there are fundamentals of the uranium industry that we should be looking at?
So it's, uranium is a very interesting, very, very niche space. What it got going for it from a macro theme is the fact that nuclear reactors is still a very, very cost-efficient, scalable way of producing electricity. I mean, obviously, there are very sad safety concerns that are brought up, and rightfully so, might I add. But technology has been continuously evolving. And let's be honest, the number of nuclear reactors that are out there in the world right now, especially in the U.S. and in more developed parts of Europe, that have all these safety nets in place to ensure that an ample amount of electricity in a cost-effective manner can be produced is great, right? So from that regard, I don't envision or see that, you know, the entire world is going to go down the path of purely solar or wind energy, but nuclear is going to play a large part in that. So from that regard, I think, you know, that provides a nice floor to the demand for uranium. What's been happening interesting in the markets recently is there's this, it's kind of like what's going on in Bitcoin to some extent, where you have a certain finite amount of uranium, or Bitcoin in this case, but over here, uranium.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this fund whose ticker is SPRUUF that's been buying up a lot of this underlying good just to keep it in the trust, right? It's like an investment fund that continuously goes out and buys a large amount of uranium relative to the market size and just buys it and stores it. So when you take that amount of uranium out of the market, we've been seeing a continuous spike up in prices, and contingent to, you know, this fund, the only thing it can do is just buy uranium, right? And it becomes like a never-ending cycle, right, where more and more people are looking at uranium prices going up. They want exposure into that. This is the ticker to buy into. You buy it. That just means that there's less amount of uranium that's in the market for reactors to buy. So they start stockpiling also. And we just see a huge spike up. I think, you know, we're still at the very more initial to middle innings of this. And I think that's one sector that I've deployed a certain amount of capital to be invested in.
I'm just looking at the chart of the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust Fund. Wow, it's been on the up and up, really, just two dips in 2019 and May 2020. But apart from that, upward trajectory, now trading at about $11.12, up 1.4%. So you see this rally in uranium continuing at least for the near term.
I do. I mean, it's just the sheer amount of capital that's still available, and you've got to figure out where can you deploy it, right? So
right.
More and more of these technology stocks that get corrections, okay, so that's kind of out. Fixed income, inflation running hot, interest rates going up, okay, that's kind of out. Got to go into underlying core businesses, right? Either consumer stocks or buy the actual underlying physical commodity in a way. And so Japanese trading houses have been doing really well. Oil has been on a fantastic tear in the past like couple of months. Natural gas, uranium, all these underlying goods that have been beaten down so badly the past like, you know, couple of years, I think they're going to see a reemergence to play a certain percentage of an investor's portfolio. And that's kind of like what happened to Bitcoin, right? Like if, you know, everyone kept saying, why can't investors just have like 1 or 2% invested into Bitcoin?
Mm-hmm.
And sure, I mean, when the world's investors all start putting in 1 or 2% into Bitcoin, we see the prices rallying to 40, 50,000, if not more.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that we're going to start seeing in these underlying, you know, natural gas, oil, uranium, et cetera, until a lot of capital gets deployed to ensure that the supply can increase. And that's something that OPEC has been calling out in the case of oil, where because of the lack of investment of money being put into enhancing the oil rigs and new technologies being deployed in that space, supply is naturally shrinking. And with the world economy, you know, opening up again and potentially overheating to some extent over the next 6 to 9 months, a lot of demand coming back into the market, it's just natural that it's a marketplace, right? You have much higher demand, limited supply, and the amount of time, the capex time that it takes, the capital cycle time it'll take before new uranium enrichment facilities or new oil producing facilities can come onto the market, there's that period of maybe 6 months to over a year that investors can try and capitalize on.
Oh, that makes me happy to think about that period. Now, speaking of happiness, can digital cash lift the gross national happiness of the tiny Himalayan kingdom of Bhutan, for whom cash was a recent invention? I mean, up to the 50s, people were bartering in Bhutan over rice and butter and cheese and meat and wool. But Bhutan wants a digital currency. And so will going digital make the 800,000 strong, mostly Buddhist society happier than it already is, Arun?
You know, honestly, Michelle, I do not understand CBDCs or central banks like their own digital currencies, other than if the central bank just wants to be able to monitor the flow of money, be it inflow and outflow.
That's it.
A lot more, you know, to the point of, like, I can see exactly why China wants to do it. Right. Mm-hmm. When you have capital controls and you're so concerned about money leaving, how do you try and control the money flow? From that regard, I 100% get it. And I read that article, you know, of Bhutan coming out with its own thing and other central banks exploring all of this. And this theme has been around how it's going to facilitate financial inclusion, how it's going to be better for the overall GDP. And I personally don't see that. Like, I think private companies coming up with more seamless ways of transferring money from one person to the other, I can completely respect and can buy how that can increase GDP. And if you look at Stripe, right, like one of the world's largest private companies still, they're a payments company and their company slogan is literally increasing the world's GDP because it facilitates good transfers. You know, people can buy and sell things more easily. Two clicks on your app and you're kind of done. Or small e-commerce merchants can set up their shop a lot more easily, you know, connecting with Shopify, with Stripe in the background, all of that stuff. I get that. But central banks trying to get a lot more hands-on involved, I think it's only for control. And that being said, though, I still think it's less of a disaster than countries like El Salvador coming out saying Bitcoin is legal tender. Bitcoin drops by 20% in a day or 2 days, which had happened, and there are riots immediately.
Mm.
Not to say that emerging countries, sadly, you know, their underlying currencies can whipsaw a lot. We saw that in Myanmar recently, right? Like, I think in the last 1 month, the currencies dropped by like 25 or 30%. But relying, at least they have some element of control over it, or they can go to the IMF, they can go to the World Bank, restructure their foreign debt, and come up with some kind of a solution. If you're completely behest at Bitcoin, which is controlled by nobody, and that's the whole purpose of it, begs a lot of questions. And similarly, even their own digital currency, it's just more of a control play rather than anything else. I just don't see the value. But a lot of countries are going down that path, right? Like MAS2, coming up with its own digital currency, so many other countries out here. It'll be interesting to see what the payment space is going to look like over the next 3 to 5 years. But from a, being in the fintech startup ecosystem, some of the world's largest private companies and some of the most amount of money from venture capital are going into this space. So it's changing day by day. It's really interesting.
It really is. I mean, people used to escape to Bhutan because it was so remote. You know, people like the idea that there are two ATMs in this northern region of Bhutan. And here it is, you know, this sort of laboratory for what could expect with digital currency. All right, final question for you, Aaron, for the day. When will we see the demise of physical currency?
honestly, the extent of like the currency notes itself going away, I think it's two very different things, right? Like the digital currency aspect vis-a-vis just trying to take all the physical notes and doing stuff electronically. I mean, to be honest, I have not held a note or touched a coin, like an actual, like a $1 Singapore coin, in, I don't know, maybe a couple of weeks right now, because all the food courts over here, all the restaurants, everyone takes card. And now given COVID, it's not even like giving them your credit card. It's literally just taking your phone and tapping it on their screen so that you don't touch anything of theirs, they don't touch anything of yours. Mm. And it's a lot more sanitary and stuff, right? So from that regard, I think most countries have already gone digital to a very large extent, which brings me back to that point of, I love the fact that, DBS has partnered up with Google Pay, so that on my phone, I don't even need to take my credit card out right now. I can just open up any digital app, I can touch it, or like a Fave wallet, or GrabPay, or Gojek Dollars. Everything has been converted into some aspect of digitization already. I earn my salary, it's not given to me in cash, it's transferred digitally into my bank account, take money from my bank account, transfer it to my wallet, or through Google Pay's credit card features, etc. And I can go about living my day-to-day life in a completely purely digital manner. So from that aspect, I really find it hard to believe that, more than say maybe 4 to 5 years, more than like say 5% of transactions in relatively developed countries are going to take place using currencies. I mean, look at India, right? Like Paytm, one of India's largest fintech startups, they revolutionized how small merchants do not need to keep carrying cash, then going in the evening and depositing it somewhere or losing it. Like that entire aspect has gone off hard currency. So from that regard, I think, on the one hand, you've got developed countries that have, their smartphones and using digital currencies already, or digitization of currency, I would say. And on the other hand, you have very emerging markets that are doing the exact same thing through extremely savvy, cool fintech apps. I just don't see a space for why anyone will want to go back to counting notes and coins and receiving change, dangling in their pocket, all of that stuff.
Interesting. Yeah. And there's a great book. I like to end with a book recommendation. It's a great book that really looks at this whole area of the future of money and how the digital revolution is here and is transforming currencies. And it's by Eswar S. Prasad. And I think what he raises, which is interesting for me, is that aspect of this digital transformation, the challenge to money as what counts as legal tender. Who is the issuer? Who is the guarantor? How is that going to change? So maybe we can pick up on that next time, Aaron.
Very true. What's the name of the book, please, again, sorry? I've not read it.
Yeah, it's really good. The title of the book is The Future of Money.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah. On my to-do, my read list.
Great. It's by Eswar S. Prasad. Aaron, you have a fabulous day. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, as always, Michelle.
He's Aaron Pai, Chief Strategy Officer at Flow, and he shares his take on the economy with us right here on Your Money.
Before acting on the information on Money FM, please consider if it's suitable for your own investment objectives, financial situation, and risk tolerance. To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download our audio app. That's AWEDIO. Available on Google Play or the App Store.